Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey guys, you ever wonder what Phil and I wear while we podcast? You can find out if you join our Patreon. We'll also be talking about the films of 1989, but that's definitely less important than seeing our Zoom backgrounds, our headphone choices, and our sweatshirts.
It's true. It's true. You'll get to see all the various pieces of artwork that I have framed on my office wall, and you can see Kenny's garden, sort of. So that's something. That's exciting.
It's a hanging garden.
It's a hanging garden. But perhaps more important than anything, we are doing this Patreon to cover the best films of 1989. Batman, When Harry Met Sally, Indiana Jones, The Last Crusade, Ghostbusters 2, with amazing guests like Tom Meissen, Liz Hanna, Joanna Robinson, Brian Cogman, Chuck Hayward. You can sign up at patreon.com/podcastlikeit's1989. And for $5, you'll get access to all the audio of these fantastic episodes. For a few bucks more, you'll get video as well of our 99 and 89 episodes. And perhaps, most importantly, you'll be supporting us so we can just keep making podcast content for you guys.
Hello and welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1999 from under a bearskin here in 2022. I'm one of your hosts, Kenny Nybart.
And I am Phil Iscove.
And with us once again, Darren Franich from Entertainment Weekly, but you probably know him from really trying to get Resident Evil on that zombie draft, like over and over. It's like, he's like, I have to play Resident Evil. I know there are six more Romero movies, but when are you going to let me play Resident Evil? Yep. Why did you push it so hard, Darren?
In fairness, I think I just had it in my discards and said,
"You never played it.
It's a
you never
pretty good
it.
Movie. Yeah. I think it's yeah. I think it's a fun movie. That is a movie that I will stand movie. For.
It's a good franchise. I would even go as far as to say like a fun franchise as a whole.
Those are bold statements that I can't necessarily condone, but I will just say that first one, there are very cool scenes in it. Maybe the coolest scene, arguably stolen from a different movie, but you know, homage is the most sincere form of flattery. So I like that first Resident Evil movie. It's not quite as good as the video games, but it also has nothing to do with the video games. So it stands on its own, one shambling foot.
I would also say too that like, Mila Jovovich, forgive me if I'm mispronouncing it, is a legit action hero totally that I feel agree. Like we never really capitalized on. Like, she's fucking awesome in those Resident Evil movies. And I guess on some level, she was just like, I don't know, I don't really want. But like, how did she not land in one of a million Marvel movies? How does she not land in one of these things? Unless she just doesn't want to do it anymore, which you know, more power to her, but she's just cool. And I feel like we're kind of leaving money on the table.
Yeah. You especially feel that in the third Resident Evil movie, Extinction, which is when the clone stuff starts coming in. And you're just like, this is a cool screen presence. And admittedly, yeah, those movies were like the mom and pop, like, you know, cafe version of a franchise with her and her husband sort of, you know, yeah, working on it, yeah, so long. But you are just like, there are many, many performers who are cast in much bigger movies with, yeah, way less screen presence than this.
No, for sure.
She had a very odd career in, yeah, in a way, because she really blew, you know, like kind of blew the doors off in Fifth Element.
For sure.
And we did The Messenger, which was her 1999 film. And that was an Oscar play. You know, they, yep, really did think that she was going to...
Are you, a Messenger fan, Darren?
It's a mind-blowing movie. It's a mind-blowing movie. Like, I rented it on VHS, thinking it was going to kind of be, you know, kind of a, like, swordplay type movie. And having,
a 13th
like,
Warrior, song, if you will. Yeah.
A 13th, yeah, Warrior type film, which at the time I really, really liked, that genre of film.
Sure.
And yeah, I was not expecting all the, like, Dustin Hoffman as devil or angel. Just the general grotesquery of The Messenger. It's,
yeah,
interesting.
Yeah,
it's a weird movie.
It is. It doesn't know what it's doing. And like, it's not. I'm not sure if John Malkovich makes the movie or breaks the movie.
Correct. Correct. That's the right assessment.
Because like, it's weird. Because it's if you think the movie is trash, he makes the movie. If you think the movie is like almost kind of good, like I do, and that she's really giving like 110%, then he kind of undermines what she's doing, which is really what I think. I think she like is, you know, giving a really, really, you know, kind of full-hearted, full-bodied performance.
Well, the great thing about her performance there, which I think is also great in some of the Resident Evils, is like she can look really insane when she wants to. And the fact that that movie is kind of at times in a way that's not fully digested, digging into what motivated Joan of Arc. Yeah, there's interesting stuff there mixed in with a lot of other.
Oh, 100%. I mean, I would argue actually, and it is actually, it does connect to the film we're going to talk about today, 13th Warrior, which I think is also treading in really fertile, interesting terrain that I'm not sure everybody got their arms fully around. But it doesn't take away from the fact that it's an interesting movie. Like, you know, Darren, you were on for Three Kings, another numeral movie that you were on for, which, you know, is also got a lot of big ideas. I think is a lot more successful than this film. But 13th Warrior and Messenger, there's more in common there than you kind of would think. I mean, two very successful action directors who decided to take it upon themselves to try to kind of do a period piece, fictionalized account of some kind of versions of history, like mixed with the supernatural in a weird way. Like they're weirdly kind of similar.
Right. They're both kind of tackling these myths. It feels like in both cases, you have the directors, Luc Besson and John McTiernan, these like action titans who just were running rampant through
the 90s,
80s, you know, into the 90s. It's kind of clear that they're kind of trying to do what I think to them would have been like, you know, as guys kind of raised in a different time, would have been like, well, I got to do my epic. I got to do my Lawrence of Arabia. I got to do my kind of David Lean movie. Mm-hmm. Not that either film even remotely feels that way for reasons that are worth kind of talking about with 13th Warrior especially. But it's interesting to see how that gets mixed with, this kind of perversion of that. A lot of gross stuff. 13th Warrior especially is one of the muddiest movies ever made. Yeah.
It's a muddy movie.
It's a brown movie.
It's impressive how much was spent on making a movie that is largely obscured by mud.
It's interesting because I feel like you're also seeing two very different careers in terms of Luc Besson, which for good or bad has always been pretty much in total control of what he makes, right? From a monetary perspective, France just gives him as much money as he wants to do basically whatever he wants. And
he's the best of them.
Sure.
Well,
I mean, I'm going to stay out of that, but I'm just going to say that I think that this film, which is, you've got McTiernan, who is obviously a, you know, American filmmaker, as you said, lots of very successful action films under his belt, Die Hard, Hunt for Red October, Predator. And for whatever reason, he decides to do this film, which he has not really explained why he wanted to do this film, but he did. And it just, it's Touchstone, so it's Disney. There's a lot of money there. It kind of, I would argue that on some level, Crichton felt like perhaps he really had his hands in the pie here in a way that, he took over the film and directed the reshoots. So like clearly he was very involved. It feels like a troubled movie, and you really do sense it in the cut. I mean, this movie
it's a disaster production.
Yeah,
the story was that
you can see Darren's face right now, just gleefully smiling.
And the story, as far as I remember from what I read, is McTiernan directed it. They spent $60 million. They finished the film. The film was not great. Test screening said, this is awful.
Yep.
They came back and they said, we have to do some reshoots. Now, Crichton did direct the reshoots on one stage. And McTiernan directed other reshoots on another stage. Oh, and they basically, had a bake-off between these two versions of the endings. And they went with Michael Crichton's ending, director of Coma, and Westworld, which is like unwatchable schlock, like the flattest looking movie you'll ever see. Makes the Itchy and Scratchy Land episode look like Lawrence of Arabia. He beats out the director of Die Hard.
Correct.
And it's better sequel, Die Hard with a Vengeance.
A hot take from
so much, man. Like, watch out, France. Yeah. Watch out, Die Hard. Yeah,
you know me.
You know, fireballs.
You know, Jordan Cucciola feels the same way. So now what?
I mean,
all right.
She also loves Escape from L.A. So take
no, she doesn't.
She does.
I also like Escape from L.A. I also like Escape from L.A. But I do want to zero in on something you're talking about, Kenny.
Go ahead. That's basically the nuts and bolts they want to spend. They want to spend $100 million more, this $160 million film, to tack on this ending at the end that basically is like let's get the secondary.
I also just want to say one quick thing, Darren, before you jump in, which is that is fucking crazy. What studio says you guys can both do reshoots and we'll pick one? That's like, and we'll just burn the money on the other fucking reshoots. It's insane. Please, Darren, go ahead.
It's just such an interesting time for both of them. I mean, one thing that's easy to forget is Michael Crichton was such a dominant figure in the 90s.
Bulletproof.
In a way that, I mean, you have to think about an author, you know, someone on the level of like your J.K. Rowling's, but somehow doing it not necessarily with a franchise, just like, you know, between drafts.
He's the franchise.
He was the franchise. Yeah. And this film, if I recall correctly, because after seeing it when I was a kid, I loved it so much that I went out to get Eaters of the Dead, the book it's based on.
Sure.
Which is almost unreadable. But this was an earlier book by him. Yes. And it has some of that feeling of it's the mid-90s, Crichton is hot, whatever he's done before, this could be the next Jurassic Park, we gotta blast it. And then you have McTiernan, who was coming off of a great era that was now just beginning its general descent after Last Action Hero and everything. So it seems like you had these big creative voices given a lot of, clearly from the studio, a lot of money and a lot of room, and just neither of them really figuring out, it seems to me, what they were doing. Because with on the McTiernan side, there's parts of this movie where I am kind of like, oh, this could be like Predator with Vikings. Yep. You know, there's even like some lines that kind of echo Predator in terms of like, you know,
it could have been if they made one big difference.
Well, I think it's like 20 big differences.
They only really needed to do one thing.
What's what they need to do?
Make them actual bears.
Actual bear men. Actual bear men. Cause when I thought they were actual bear men for a second, I was so in. And then I went far out.
You were like, this is like too blandly realistic. We need true fantasy in this.
Yes, I was like, yes. Cause I remember seeing Congo, which was kind of the first one.
The ultimate post Jurassic Park Crichton wave. Yes.
The first one after.
Sphere and Congo.
And Sphere is, you know, Sphere has that like, what we're grasping for straws. Whereas, even though it was a big novel, like Andromeda Strain, like there were like these big Crichton novels that felt nothing like Jurassic Park, whereas Congo was like Jurassic Park with silverback apes and or silverback gorillas. And but they were like super, they were like super intelligent, right? And they were like super evolved, and there was something sci-fi about it. And I thought, like, when I thought that these were actual bear men, I perked up. Like, here we go, bear men.
I felt the same way. To be here, here's the thing: I wanted them to be bear men, but I also knew that they weren't bear men because I was just like, I don't think it's going to go there. But I want to just dig into the Crichton thing for a quick second here, because Crichton is a fascinating career in the sense that, like, he has kind of stages. He is a big deal in the 80s. I mean, Andromeda Strain is big. Westworld, for what, you know, whether you like it or not, was a, you know, relatively
Westworld's
big movie.
A big deal.
He has all these, like, he's no slouch in the 80s. Now, obviously,
you're talking about the 70s, Phil.
Sorry, 70s. Yes. Correct.
Yeah.
He obviously, that all goes into fucking hyperdrive when Jurassic Park hits, right? And then it's like the guy's putting out a book basically once a year, it feels like. And it's one kind of pseudoscience thing after another. And he finds a really interesting way to kind of ground his stuff in believable pseudoscience. That's kind of the world that he traffics in.
I mean, I wonder, like, if you guys feel the same way. As a kid in the 90s, I felt like Michael Crichton books were not just fun, but they were also like scientific, and they were I'm glad you used the word pseudoscientific. I did not think of them as pseudo. I was like, this is like bleeding edge, like direct from the front lines of what's going on with science right now.
how does he know?
What's kind of crazy is, like, you guys are old enough to remember a pre-Jurassic Park world when nobody thought that, or nobody taught that dinosaurs and birds had anything to do with each other.
Yeah.
That was not taught. It, well, I remember distinctly, were they mammals or were they reptiles?
Yep.
And after that, people started to take that idea seriously to the point where now it's just what is taught. That is what is taught in schools, that they're the direct antecedent to birds.
Yep.
So that's interesting to me in its own way, because I think you're kind of right, Darren, that, like, it's more than even like we thought it was bleeding edge. Like, it kind of was.
Yeah.
Like the DNA Amber stuff, like, that kind of has been done.
Well,
so,
it's also I would argue, I never knew what a velociraptor was before Jurassic Park. It's like he invented a dinosaur. He didn't. But, like, there is something about the way that Crichton was able to you know, excavate these pieces of science that feel like he invented something.
The velociraptor shit's amazing to me.
Right?
He basically just found the new cool dinosaur.
Yeah.
You know?
It's crazy.
Yeah. And your hometown NBA team. You're saying
what you needed more of from 13 Fourier was like a scientifically almost accurate bear person.
Correct.
Who
Correct.
comes out of the cave.
Yes.
They have a whole bear culture.
Correct.
There's a big bear mother.
Better movie.
I wouldn't have minded if it was some kind of bear human community, where humans had been raised by bears just because they lived in the remote parts of, like, you know, Scandinavia, and they would, like, kind of take it on bear stuff. But I think if it were bear men, I would have liked it more, but it would have been less great.
So apparently in the book, and you probably remember this, Darren, but in the book, they are revealed to be Neanderthals, descendants of Neanderthals.
Well,
in this, the mist monsters, which is what we're sort of alluded to in the movie, are never really explained as to what their background is.
So, Phil, you're exactly right. But if it's okay, because I've been waiting 20 years to talk about this, let's pull the curtain back even further. I believe that in Eaters of the Dead, Michael Crichton puts forward that he specifically wrote the book because one of his friends, a kind of unnamed professor, told him, you know, Beowulf is very boring, to which Michael Crichton said, I can make it not boring. So then Michael Crichton, the writer of, like, Congo,
Andromeda Strain,
and Andromeda Strain. You know, a fun series of books. Also the writer of Timeline. Michael Crichton said, I can take the raw, disgusting clay that is Beowulf, one of the most like singular works of, you know, human imagination that we have today, and I can make it better. And I sort of think that, like, I'd love to imagine, I tried to find some interviews with him, and I think a lot of people, just by the time the 13th Warrior came out, I think a lot of people attached to it just were not really talking about it. But I'd be really curious to know if with 13th Warrior, he sort of felt like, you know, if Eaters of the Dead was him being like, I can make Beowulf even better. If on some level with this one, he was kind of like, I can do like the better kind of ancient epic movie, you know, this genre that had been around for a while, but had been dormant for a while. Because there are parts of the movie, I guess weirdly, a lot of the stuff with Antonio Banderas's character, there's just a little bit of this nudging towards, oh, like, okay, this guy is a Muslim. What would that be like for him in this kind of cultural arena with these pagans, with the Vikings? There's just enough of that that as a kid, I was like, this is amazing. This is mind blowing. And now as an adult, I'm kind of like, I don't think a lot of this is really mapped in very well to what's actually going on.
But in the book, I have not read the book. You've read the book. So I don't know about you guys, but this film clocks in at a little over 90 minutes long. So it feels like it's been kind of gutted in the editing room. Generally speaking, Kenny, I think you would agree, most of the movies that we watch, I don't necessarily say this should be longer, but like this movie does feel like it throws you in the deep end really from the jump. And there's a real lack of nuance in what you're talking about, Darren, in terms of this culture clash that exists between these Vikings and this Muslim man. Also, spoiler, Antonio Banderas, not a Muslim. So we should probably say that's problematic.
The eyeshadow.
Eyeliner,
Which between this and The Mummy, I feel like this is one of those like suddenly the 20th century seems very far away indeed.
Correct.
There's something even like... I mean, I really took The Mummy to task when we did that.
You did,
because I don't really like, I don't like crypt robbing shit. Like, I think like, I just think that's kind of gross to me. Including like Indiana Jones, but
no France, no Die Hard 2, no crypt robbing. We're
correct.
Wait. I didn't say no Die Hard 2.
He said Die Hard 3 better than 1. That was which it is. Take. That's crazy.
I'll tell you the whole thing. I love Die Hard 1, love Die Hard 3 more. Dislike France, dislike England more.
You know what he also doesn't like? The other 1999 John McTiernan film, The Thomas Crown Affair.
Don't like Thomas Crown at all. Very bad film.
Very fun film.
Like The Mummy more enjoyable than Thomas Crown. But I think that if...
National Treasure... That is her magnum opus. That's all
she's
I'm going to say.
She's great in that movie.
I don't know. Have you ever seen Tin Cup?
She is great in Tin Cup. That is Renee Russo is a national treasure.
You ever seen Nightcrawler?
Is the Holy Trilogy. That's the Holy Trinity.
And Major League, of course. But Holy Quadrilogy. Long way of saying there are some problematic things going on with this movie with Antonio Banderas playing a Muslim, playing an Arab, a Muslim Arab, and he is a Spaniard wearing eyeliner, using his Spanish accented English throughout this film. But it is so fucking silly. It is like so over the top silly. You get over it very fast without even casting aspersions on anybody.
It's so bizarre, it's so stupid. Yeah,
it's like it's such a goof on a goof on a goof that it's and like Omar Sharif plays like his buddy. But like if they cast an actual Muslim Arab in that role, as you know they perhaps should have, it almost would have been an insult to that actor because this movie's so silly.
I don't disagree that it's a silly movie, but I also, to sort of my point earlier, I think they've removed the stuff that might not have made it silly. Like, there's a part of me that feels like at a certain point they were like, okay, this movie's hemorrhaging money. It's cost us $1 billion. Let's just fucking get this thing short. Let's get as many screenings as we can for the first couple of weeks, and hopefully we can make some of our money back. And I think that they pulled a lot of the substance from this movie. So what you're kind of left with is just sort of vestiges and like action sequences, which are very well orchestrated, and, but I mean, that's kind of it.
And we should, the one thing that is pretty well done are the action sequences on the fights.
Yes.
But particularly the one in the cave looks amazing and is really exciting and thrilling. This is
shot in a real cave.
If they shot in a real cave.
I mean, that's fucking nuts. Like, it, I mean, if
they did everything you did in an effort to make some money, they failed, because this is the biggest box office bomb of 1999. And some consider it the biggest box office bomb of all time.
which I think it's amazing, because no one ever talks about it like that. Do you know what I like?
No one ever talks about it, period. This isn't, like, isn't Cutthroat Island, right?
Like, this movie doesn't exist, Aaron, and it potentially lost a studio almost $120 million.
Well, let me ask a quick question here. Just I'm putting all this together in the same way that a few times in this movie the camera cuts to Antonio Banderas as he is kind of figuring stuff out. Like, I think there's one. I mean, you guys are storytellers, so maybe you feel like there's one scene where you're just like, wow, this must have been a rewrite on the set that day.
Yeah.
Where he just kind of is looking around and says, they think they're bears. Yes. Where did bears go? And it's like, how are you putting together an entire...
I love it so much.
That's pretty good stuff. That's
like, so there's a few moments like that, but I'm doing that now. I'm listening to you guys talk.
But I also
realizing,
please.
Sounds to me like you two had not seen this movie.
No, never seen this movie. Never saw this film before.
Is that correct?
Correct.
So let me.
They think they're bears moment.
let me tell you that they think they're bears. Let me bring you guys into my cave.
Yeah,
please. Here, if that's okay, let's jump over the waterfall. Let's go down into where the fertility goddess.
Just keep your poison claw to yourself. All right.
So, in 1999, I saw this movie in theaters. I guess I was one of 100 people around the world who saw it in theaters. The box office was gross. I saw it with my mom, who was excited because she read that Omar Sharif was in it. And I assume after the third scene, she was kind of like, "When is Omar Sharif?" Well, going to be any, coming back.
Any Beowulf retelling is a great mother-son movie to begin with.
for some reason, they didn't really oversell the whole Beowulf thing, which is too bad because I do think that, like, if you look at this as a, like, Beowulf reboot, which is not language I think anyone should use with the movie, you're kind of like, okay, you're doing some fun stuff here, Crichton, with, you know, instead of the monsters, they're... Mm-hmm. Neanderthal or Cro-Magnon or some kind of lost, generation of people. But in 1999, when this came out, I saw it in a movie theater and I walked out and I said, that is one of the best movies ever made. And I often thought about how much I liked the movie over the next few years, because nobody else talked
about it.
As you were saying, Phil, it just seemed totally lost. Then one day on TV, would have been late 2003, it was playing. I turned it on. I said, this is not good. What was I thinking? And I turned it off. And I have not watched it again since then. And thinking about that, watching it this go round, first time I've watched it all the way through in like 22 years, I think what changed was when this movie came out, you know, there just hadn't really been a lot of films like it. You know, you can kind of say that it was taking that kind of mud-swept battle footage style from something like Henry V or you
Braveheart.
Know, Braveheart certainly was a preeminent one, but even that kind of felt like a more recent, this is kind of that ancient epic
period. Yes.
And then it's kind of like right after this comes out, a year later, you have Gladiator. The year after that, you know, you have in the fantasy realm, like Lord of the Rings. There are some parts of this movie where the mist monsters are coming, where I swear the soundtrack almost kind of sounds like the kind of battle Uruk-hai soundtrack from the Lord of the Rings. So just, you're kind of like, this was kind of right there at the start. And I think if you wanted a movie like that, and I loved Viking stuff, I loved Norse mythology, that really spoke to me as a kid. And then it was just right after that, all the better versions came out. And like,
yeah.
there was not much reason to revisit this, which besides, as you said, some cool filming locations, the fact they actually built that whole village, I think, was really cool and certainly feels nice today. But it was just like, it immediately felt very old-fashioned by comparison to something like Gladiator. Just even the kind of post-Gladiator, post-Lord of the Rings wave of ancient, real, or fantastical movies, those all just felt like, for a lot of different reasons, there was more going on with them than certainly there was here.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because we 99 was the focal point for so many types of films. Where you'll see things like, you know, you'll see you'll see Blair Witch in the beginning of the year and Haunting in the end of the year. You'll say essentially like, all right, out with the old and with the new, here we are. And you see it with Matrix and something like 13th Floor, where that was something that looks very 13th Floor looks very Lawnmower Man-ish, and they didn't get the new technology that they made with Matrix and that kind of stuff. We haven't seen it with this kind of historical epic type thing yet. And I think you nailed it, Darren. I do think that in the coming years, really, really good directors. And I don't...
Gladiator's really, 2000, right? So it's like 6 months away.
Literally, yeah, literally in production while this is... While
and
this
I'm
is
not trying
going
to,
out and flopping, yeah.
I'm not trying to throw shade at McTiernan, who I think is a really, really good director. But he's not the visual wizard that Ridley Scott or Peter Jackson is. Mm-hmm. And I think that kind of scope and understanding of practical sets and understanding of mixing CGI with practical sets and the ability to have, frankly, multiple characters with multiple storylines going on at one time without getting completely lost, because I don't know who the fuck any of these guys are, particularly the Norsemen.
They're all covered in dirt too, right? So like you've got yes, everyone's just like
the yes, dirt men. Yes, the
yeah,
blonde dirt
like
men.
Dirty blonde.
I think
men.
That I do think that this does feel a little bit like at the time no one liked this, obviously, but yeah, very soon after you were shown a way to do this in a modern setting that lasts more or less up until today. I mean, it lasts up until the Green Knight. So this is still a viable Green Knight didn't do well, but that's not really the point. This is a viable modern type of movie that I think we saw the last kind of death throes of with this particular film.
I agree.
I think it's interesting that I don't know how old you were in 99, Darren, but I think it was interesting that you left this movie saying this is one of the best movies ever made, because for you at the time, you probably didn't see a lot of movies like this on the big screen. You know,
there had certainly not been a lot of movies like this in theaters. Like I think I saw Braveheart
in the
second
half of the 90s for sure.
Yeah, I was like 14, and this was kind of like right at that moment of, you know, I mean, even the idea of a big historical epic, you know, it was kind of so few and far between before this, mixed with the fact that I think a thing I liked about the movie at the time and that I still almost like about it, what you guys are describing as, you know, it's sort of so cut to the bone and like, mm-hmm. you know, Diane Venora, who's a real, like,
yeah.
an actual performer, she's in it so little where you're just like, there must have been more with her. Mm-hmm. There's all this stuff with the local king where you're like, there must have been more there that's all lost. I think the fact that it was so cut to the bone, mm-hmm. that felt like more of a choice to me at the time. Like I was like, okay, like,
sure.
yeah, there's the tall Viking. He's tall, he's quiet. Like literally in the end credits, most of the Vikings have little parenthetical descriptions next to them. So you even barely know who they are. Like, I think what I perceived as minimalism at the time now just feels like, you know, there's not a lot of relationships here.
Yeah.
Besides, I will say there's the one really peppy Viking guy. I believe he's actually credited as Hergr parentheses the Joyous, played by Dennis Storhoy. I really like him. I think sure. like I almost wonder if they cut out everybody else and filmed more with him in the reshoots.
Hergr the Joyous.
Is he the guy who cuts off the guy's head in that like fight?
That guy's cool. Yes.
Yeah,
that guy seemed to have a relationship with Antonio Banderas.
Correct.
That's
correct.
The only relationship
to
really grasp onto in the movie.
Yeah.
And I assume, like, you know, just thinking about every other movie like this, as big as they get, the best ones do seem to have these like pivotal, you know, mm-hmm. 1-2-3 person dynamics. And in this movie, yeah, it's kind of just that guy making fun of, but also liking Antonio Banderas. Like that's kind of the only thing you can really grasp onto on a personal level.
Totally. I want to give a little context for our listeners after 45 minutes, because that's the best time to give context. The synopsis is a Muslim ambassador exiled from his homeland, Ahmed Ibn Fadlan, I believe. I don't know how you pronounce it. My apologies.
I love the idea that they had ambassadors all the way back.
Yeah,
then.
Sure.
What's he going to do? Send a carrier pigeon back with the news?
The company of Vikings with the while the behavior of the Norsemen initially offends him, the more cultured outsider grows to respect the tough, if uncouth, warriors. During their travels together, he and the Vikings get word of the evil presence closing in, and they must fight the frightening, formidable force, which is previously thought to exist only in legend. The 13th Warrior opened on August 27th, 1999, against The Sixth Sense, Runaway Bride, Bowfinger, and Mickey Blue Eyes. It would go on to make $61 million on a $160 million budget. It's got 33% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics, 66% from audiences. Ebert gave it 1.5 stars. Saying, arriving at last, more than a year after it was completed, The 13th Warrior shows every sign of a production run amok with a budget said to be more than $100 million. It displays a lot of cash on screen, but little thought. To extract the story from the endless scenes of action and carnage is more effort than it's worth. The film seems to have been conceived from the special effects on down instead of beginning with a good story, then adding FX as needed. It apparently began with FX, and then the story was shoehorned onto it and pauses in the action. I don't agree with that. But anyway, it could have been different. This could indeed have been a fascinating tale based on Eaters of the Dead, a 1974 novel by Michael Crichton. The story combines two intriguing sources. One, the real-life adventures of Fadlan, a Muslim poet who traveled north to the Viking lands in the 10th century, and the other is the old English epic poem Beowulf. The other review that I think is kind of amazing is Lisa Schwartzbaum of Entertainment Weekly.
Yes, yes, yes. I just pulled that up on my phone. Yes. Okay. Sorry. Please.
I was gonna. You know.
She loved it.
She gave it an A-, called it the most unexpectedly audacious, exhilarating, and wildly creative adventure film I've seen in ages. So listen, your cohorts at Entertainment Weekly, Darren, think similarly to you. As a 13-year-old.
I'm so glad you bring this up, because when I left the theater, and again, when I said to myself, well, this is one of the best movies ever made, and I looked at like all the reviews that were being written about the movie, waiting for someone else to say, this movie is amazing, disappointed by literally everyone from local newspaper critic up to Roger Ebert. Mm-hmm. And then I opened my copy of Entertainment Weekly, and Lisa Schwartzbaum felt to me like she nailed it. This is your personal origin story.
It's why you work at Entertainment Weekly.
Oh, I mean, listen, Lisa Schwartzbaum, that was the era where like her and Owen Gleiberman, like what they were saying was fully like forming my brain in every way. But she describes the storytelling style of the movie as pontilistic, nearly word-free. And I think like that's intentional. That's how it hit me at the time. And I still feel that way at times in the movie. I think mainly with, I got to look up this guy's names because they're all like, you know, Central Europeans or whatever.
Yeah.
The guy who plays, I guess he's basically the Beowulf character, the kind of lead chieftain of the
big guys
that Antonio Banderas finds himself traveling with, played by Vladimir Kulich. The idea of a movie where it's an adventure and your main character, Antonio Banderas, is not ultimately the hero of the movie. And you ultimately figure out, like, we're actually seeing this huge event through this main character's eyes. I think that's actually really interesting. I couldn't think of a lot of other movies like that. And I do think that the guy playing Beowulf, is kind of awesome. It's almost like whenever he's on screen, I'm like, you have that rough-edged quality where you seem like you were carved out of stone just to be in this movie. And, you know, I kind of feel like when you look at something both less expensive but more stylistically intense, like Valhalla Rising, the movie from years later by Nicholas Winding Refn, like, that's kind of like, that is that just extricated and made into a whole movie without a lot of the shaky dialogue and storytelling in 13th Warrior. So I still feel that a little bit. Do you guys feel that at all? Or is it just
I think I liked this film a little bit more than Kenny, but I will also say that I just had a really hard time locking into it.
Yeah.
it just, I just found it a bit of a struggle to sort of really figure out who I was supposed, outside of Antonio Banderas and Omar Sharif. I agree with Kenny in the sense that it's kind of an ocean of Nordsmen that I'm just sort of like, I don't know how I'm supposed to be feeling or connecting to you individually. But that guy I did lock into and I did like him, but you know, take that for what it's worth.
I think there was a moment where I was definitely locked. So for the most part, Phil, I agree with you. Like I found the movie somewhat impenetrable.
Yeah.
There was a moment where I think it was in that the cave with the bear fight where I was very much into it. I was like, do I like this movie? Is this going to be a great movie? I absolutely do not hate this movie.
Yeah,
far from it. Mm-hmm. I have hated some movies a lot more. I think it goes far. I think it does not stick the ending, mm-hmm. stick the landing at all.
Do you like this more or less than the Thomas Crown Affair?
That's it's an interesting question.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Kenny's putting on his hat. He's taking his briefcase into the art gallery now.
He's opening his briefcase.
Let me get back to you on that one. All right. So I've thought a lot about the Thomas Crown Affair one because I think I was trying to impress our guest that episode with how much I hated it because we all hated it. Thomas Crown, disappointed. I'm brutally disappointed by that film. I think that film has all the elements to be an A+. It's so pitched directly towards me. It has actors I love. Heists are probably my favorite subgenre of film. I particularly love an art heist. I love the locales. I love the gadgets. I love the concept of that movie so much.
Sure.
And I like the Steve McQueen version. So I in general, like, I'm very primed for a movie like that. And when it comes out, and I think it just makes no sense and misses all its opportunities, it's a shame. And I really was just kind of hurt by it. That being said, this movie is the exact opposite. This movie has, like I said to you when I saw the log line, Phil, this movie has no elements that would draw me in. I like Antonio Banderas, not as a Muslim. And I like John McTiernan, not as a director of 10th century Norway or wherever he is. I'm generally turned off by this kind of swords and horses stuff. Unless it's just exceptional, and I don't like kind of vulgarity, like vulgarity, like I don't like big hairy men spitting and cursing and farting, which you don't get a lot of in this film, but it seemed like you were going to get a lot of it. So my expectations for this film,
and he came in expecting a lot more farting, and was
I thought it was you know, Braveheart's a bit of a fart epic.
It's
a fart film, and it drives me nuts. But so my expectations for this movie were, you know, sub basement, and I thought it was pretty good, and I liked it. My expectations for Thomas Crown, I thought it was going to be one of the best books of 99, it was, you know, crushingly disappointing. No, you don't think that. You do not believe that.
We should have put Brosnan on our Brianna Ashby print.
The answer to your question is I would sooner watch Thomas Crown again.
There.
That is without question the one I would put on because I can lock into it. And I think I would be less annoying about it this time around.
Well, Darren, now I'm curious. What are your thoughts, Thomas Frenifer versus Thirteenth Warrior?
Well, first of all, in 1999, when I realized that the same guy had directed both of these movies, I, a 14-year-old, said, well, he's the best director of all time. Like, I mean, mind you, this is all, I think, still before the real rush of great movies in the fall. So that, like, that, like, I would almost say this is the end of me enjoying movies as a kid, right before just the rat-a-tat-tat of Three Kings.
Yeah, Fight this was, Club, all these interesting films before.
Like those
Schumacher had 8mm and Flawless. I mean,
I'm
joking.
I mean,
I just want to say though, these movies were released. These movies were released 2 weeks apart.
And you know, in fairness, that's because McTiernan probably felt like he'd totally disowned 13th Warrior by then.
Well, yeah,
but
I mean,
on one hand, I do have this weird feeling that, you know, I guess this is a very nostalgic thing to say. I wish there could be directors now who get these two back-to-back, relatively decent budgeted movies that are so different.
Ridley Scott this year.
Well,
last Ridley Scott, Gucci.
He's the last of of the Bear Man.
This is a unique year where things have been held for a year. Yeah.
But it's funny with both movies, which I both basically like. I do have a feeling that, like, you know, McTiernan, who was very good at this sort of, you know, straight up muscular, but usually kind of sneakily funny and witty action movie. In both cases, I'm kind of like, okay, you're taking on a certain genre. And it feels to me like the genre is kind of beating you in a way that, like, the Thomas Crown Affair, which I really like, and I like the dynamic of Pierce Brosnan and Rene Russo. I always feel like, you know, this needs to have like a little bit more flavor to it, like more romantic or more something. With this one, I think it really comes alive in the action sequences. And I do think that bizarrely, he's kind of best with some of the characters who have the least to do. Like, again, like I like the Beowulf guy, and he, you know, ultimately kind of dominates the movie in the last 20 minutes after just being a very remote figure before then. So I, you know, you sort of left feeling like there was something here, maybe. I will say, too, I love Viking stuff. I'm a sucker for it. I watched like 80% of the TV show Vikings.
I
very much enjoyed it.
Are you a Vikings fan?
I was going to ask you
the Beowulf guy was on Vikings at one point, I think, of the 100 bearded people, and that was very enjoyable. So in that sense, I'm kind of a cheap date for that. I guess I'm as cheap a date for this as Kenny would theoretically be for the Elbows and Thomas Crown Affair.
But I have, Darren, I have a question as a Viking guy. Because I was looking at this, Viking films have not historically done very well.
Oh, no.
And nor critically or commercially. But is there a seminal or some seminal Viking movies that I'm just kind of missing?
Bizarrely, I still think in a way Valhalla Rising, certainly in the 21st century, is the best. I mean, that is a Nicholas Winding Refn movie to an extreme, and it's a lot of Mads Mikkelsen just hallucinatorily killing people. But, you know, then you have the Vikings TV show, which was a success. Right. And then you could sort of make the argument that the Thor movies, just by virtue of their kind of Nordic backdrop, are tapping into that. But
I will say that I'm very excited for Robert Eggers' film, which is supposed to come out next year.
The Northmen.
The Northmen. Alex Sarsgaard, Nicole Kidman, Bjork. I'm like, yes, Bjork is back.
And I it's funny, I assume, knowing nothing about the movie except for the cast layout and the director, which is all good, all sounds good, I assume that will probably be, if not wordless, then certainly, you know, on that same kind of lighthouse witch level of you're sort of parsing out what people are saying as you go. And I think that like a certain austerity and a certain lack of understanding what's going on kind of has to come with a Viking story, because that culture is just so remote. This is one thing that I wanted to ask you guys, actually, because I sort of went back and forth on this. Is it interesting that in this movie, the main normal character, like the guy we're with, who's like the normal person from a civilization where you're just like, okay, yeah, I feel like I know where he's coming from, is the Muslim guy.
Yep.
And the kind of weirdo misfits that he's trying to understand are like these Nordic, you know, white, tall, totally impossible to fathom people. I was kind of like, I found that interesting. I wasn't sure how well the movie kind of carried that forward, but I do feel like that is an interesting approach to a Viking story.
I agree. I found that the first, 10, 15 minutes of this film were very reminiscent of Lawrence of Arabia, where I was just like, oh, okay. I mean, maybe that's what, you know, pulled John McTiernan in to a certain degree, that it's sort of this, you know, culture clash, and it's this, you know, this man who's trying to learn about a different, a different culture. But that stuff is all pretty much scrapped before the half an hour mark of the film, essentially. I wonder if there were more tendrils of that in earlier cuts. I don't know. But then it really just becomes a very muscular action film. And it should be said, he directs it incredibly well. You feel the toll of these battles, physically, emotionally, and what have you. They're bloody, they're brutal. You feel like you can literally feel the weight of their weapons. Like, it all just feels really grounded and brutal. Love all the stuff in the cave that Kenny mentioned at the end, so much so that I was just like, I wish that this entire film was subterranean. Like, I wish the whole film was in these caves. Like, that would have just been
The Descent for
right,
Vikings.
But with Vikings. Yeah. Like, something like that, you know. You understand, Kenny?
Yeah. I think just in response to what you're saying, theoretically, the idea of an Arab man going to the north to have this almost reverse Lawrence of Arabia thing is interesting. But he's not, outside of, you know, the first moment where you see him in, some sort of Arab country, he's not coded as Arab at all. I mean, he wears the keffiyeh, but he takes it off. That's how you know he becomes a cool dude.
Right.
And
this is getting into the reasons why the movie is not a cool culture clash movie.
Yeah, exactly.
He's coded maybe as Antonio Banderas, but mostly he's just kind of coded as like an American or a European. Mm-hmm. And I think that, again, this is going to sound kind of damning with fame praise. Obviously, this film is ambitious, but there's nothing ambitious about the storytelling, and there's nothing ambitious thematically about what they're doing here. So in a more ambitious movie where I felt like they were trying to make some kind of comment about the culture clash, I would be more insulted than I am in this movie, which just seems to have found a real-life historical figure that can hang this film on. Because he was a real-life guy. Who really did
totally
kind of
fascinating
travel.
Guy? Where you're like this guy's life could have sustained a much larger, you know, Dr. Zhivago-esque, you know, decades of time covered. So you're right. There is that sense of like, we're taking this guy, and it really, you know, the more you talk about this, the more I realize he's so not an active participant.
No,
in a way, it's kind of like it's like, you know, we're following along with the fifth or sixth most important warrior of this sort
I'd
of.
I'd say he's the 13th most important warrior.
But I wanted to comment on what you're saying, Darren, and you as well, Kenny. But like this idea that this real life person who was a fascinating person in his own right is being used essentially as a tool for Michael Crichton to quote unquote make Beowulf cool is just like what are we doing? Like, it's some weird exercise. And I think that part of the problem with the film as well, you know, they changed the title. It's the book's name is Eaters of the Dead, which, by the way, is a much better title. It's much more interesting. Why wouldn't you want to go see a film that's called Eaters of the Dead? I mean, I guess it sounds like a horror film, and maybe they were scared that it would scare people away. I don't know. But my point more than anything is just it feels as though there just wasn't a fully coalesced, like, what are we trying to do and say, A, with the book, which I have not read, but sounds like some weird, you know, literary exercise that Crichton took upon himself, and then a film adaptation of that, which feels more like Crichton's the hottest thing in the world right now. We should just adapt everything that he's done, even if this might not be adaptable or worthy of adapting.
The book, I should clarify, in my memory of it is meant to be this sort of faux historical, like, right. You're kind of reading the Antonio Banderas character's actual historical writings with some scholarly, fake scholarly works like attached to it. So it's even a little bit more of a exercise in historiography.
So really not fun to read.
Well, again, you're just kind of like in terms of making, like, if you wanted to make the Beowulf poem seem super fun by comparison, like, I would say maybe Eaters of the Dead is the way to go. But it's funny because what you're saying, I'm thinking about how I almost wonder if this battle is being waged in the making of the movie where, mm-hmm. you know, you have these moments like Antonio Banderas praying towards Mecca and even like tiny little things that feel very Michael Crichton to me, where it's like you learn that that for his wounds, they're putting like cow urine on him or something.
Yep.
Those little kind of historical details, which then get mixed up in, you know, again, the kind of Predator with Vikings version of the movie.
Yep.
And neither of those really seem to be connecting. There's not enough of the cultural atmosphere to dig into. Mm-hmm. And there's not quite the same propulsion on the action side. That said, I mean, man, there are just some shots of like all the kind of warriors are kind of running across the village, which to me, like maybe just watching it now after so many years of digital stuff, the village feels like a really real place where you're very aware of just how close these guys are coming to the throne room. We're just like this, you know, McTiernan is still staging this effectively, but there's not certainly no ambition in like, what are we staging here? And even how are we coherently telling this action story?
Well, there's two that come to mind to what you're saying. The first is I would actually say short of the really bad CG boat stuff when they're out on the ocean.
The first shot is
brutally bad. And then they cut back to it later. Other than that, this movie is very tactile. It's all in camera for the most part, which again, very expensive. So whenever you're actually doing this stuff, it obviously gets much more expensive. But adds so much more weight and realism to it. The other thing that I'd be remiss if I didn't quote is Omar Sharif's quote about temporarily retiring after this film, where he said, "After my small role in the 13th Warrior, I said to myself, let us stop this nonsense. These meal tickets that we do because it pays well. I thought, unless I find a stupendous film that I love and that makes me want to leave home to do, I will stop. Bad pictures are very humiliating. I was really sick. It is terrifying to have to do the dialogue from bad scripts to face a director who does not know what he's doing in a film so bad that it's not even worth exploring." That's obviously a very harsh take from Omar Sharif. But I do think it's worth noting that, you know, this is a classic actor who is you know, probably not ready for a film of this kind of physical what have you. But at the same time, I mean, he makes a good point, you know.
Let us stop this nonsense. It's really hard for me to imagine somebody who had worked with David Lean on some of the most incredible sequences in movie history. Like, his role in the movie is to sort of be the translator for, you know, it's kind of the Basil exposition guy just kind of popping up at the start to explain things. Yeah. And I can imagine him feeling a little bit like, where has this whole apparatus kind of gone wrong?
I love the translator between all these people who speak English with different accents.
Okay. We haven't even talked about the accents yet. I'm convinced, like, one of the Vikings seems to be Scottish. Like, and one of them, none of them got on the same page with what's our fake Scandinavian accent going to be here.
Well, I would argue that I'm not even really sure what Antonio Banderas' accent is in this film. I mean, he's kind of just doing Antonio Banderas, right? Like, he has not really modulated it, but there's moments when it feels like he's trying to. Did you guys get any sense of an accent from him?
No. Who's the only
He must have been told different things by the different directors.
That's fantastic.
or just like over the course of the year of film. That's some mission drift there that just nobody really had a handle on, for sure.
I also just want to just quickly talk about the cave for a quick second. The cave scenes were filmed all on location at in a cave, apparently, that measured 10,000 meters squared high, 200 meters long, 50 meters wide, 20 meters tall. Like, it was just basically this unbelievable real cave. I mean, and it looks it. I mean, this is the stuff about shooting on location, which, you know, Kenny and I both know, exceedingly more expensive to shoot on location than to shoot on stages. There's a reason why you would build this fucking cave in a stage where you can control your elements and you don't have to schlep hundreds of people inside a cave to shoot. But it looks great, right? Like you just you can't touch it. So I understand why they did it, but I mean, unbelievable.
Have you guys found generally, I mean, especially just looking at so many of the movies from this year, like as I'm getting older, I do feel like there are certain like circa late 90s basic aspects of film craft that are just so lost now or have gone so digital that like I feel like it's really repositioned my view on a lot of movies, with this movie especially. I mean, you know, I think there are some scenes that are very indifferently shot. There's just a lot of close-ups on Antonio Banderas having the same confused look on his face, which probably was him being genuinely confused. But then you get to a scene like that and you're just like, God, this is so awesome and feels like something I am not going to see again. Or if I do, it's going to be in a very reduced circumstance. So
well, it's, I guess I the cave stuff for me anyway really sort of made me think, like, you know, how there is basically five directors maybe, that Nolan basically being one of them, right, where they're just like, I demand that we go to these places and that we shoot and you're gonna feel as though you've been transported to a place. Studios don't want to do it, it's expensive, and they don't think that they need to.
There's another reason. It used to be required, but now the movie isn't made on set. The movie's made in post, and it's very brave to go out and build everything and do everything in camera like that, and potentially screw it up and potentially, you know, like kind of miss your shot or miss your moment or have to rebuild something or whatever. Now, You can try 500 different fucking things before for the same amount of money or less, and you do lose that tactileness. It's that, and it's, you know, it's the same shit everyone bitches about. It's miss the grain, out of the grain.
You miss the grain. You miss just it. I don't know. Listen, there are some incredible special effects out there. I'm sure I have been fooled by special effects more times than I can count in terms of thinking that something is real when it isn't. So I'm not sitting here and saying that people that work in special effects aren't artists in their own right, because they are and they do amazing work.
No, they're wizards.
They're right.
Like, they're wizards.
Just, it's an unbelievable thing. But to your point, Kenny, it's just like, you feel it, right? You feel like you're there.
The thing I lament, and I understand what's happened, and I've been on show. I was on a show where we shot New York streets inside a soundstage in Atlanta. So, like, I get all of this shit. Yeah. But the thing I lament is the idea that special effects stopped being things that were unachievable in the real world and started being used for things that are achievable in the real world.
Right.
And that's the thing that kind of feels wrong and weird and kind of ugly to me, you know? And I've seen all the demos, and it's truly amazing. And it's the kind of the one that kind of blew me away, and it's so stupid, but it's just, this is when we were going to get a demo of all the things you could do with green screen and why you never need to leave your fucking green screen ever again.
Yeah.
Was they shot, remember the Josh Gad show, 1600 Penn?
Yep. Yep.
Mm-hmm. They would shoot on the White House lawn and it was all green screen and no one knew. It looked incredible.
That's pretty amazing. But
you know, I give my point to Tyler Perry going and building a fucking White House. Like, that's just so much more exciting to me. The idea that there's a White House model in Atlanta that you can shoot in front of, and that's just so much cooler. So,
well, can I also say too, as someone, obviously Kenny and I have both been on sets before, when you're sitting there and you're watching the actors performing this, even if it's on a soundstage, you know what I mean? It's a built room. You can't touch it. I know Kenny and I have been in situations where you've got a partial set and you've got some extensions and you've got some screens that are going to extend it out in order to make it feel more whatever. That's one thing. But I have not personally, I can't think of, maybe I have. If I have, forgive me. Maybe I have on Sleepy Hollow. But point is, when you got an actor standing in front of a screen and they're just flailing around pretending as though something is happening around them, I don't even know how do you even tell if you've got it.
That's the point I'm making. You don't, and then you'll fix it later.
It's crazy, what seems like it should have to be more precise.
You have to be way less precise. And yeah, I'm never going to not, I hope, have that feeling when I walk onto a set and you actually see the builds and you actually see the things that you imagine to some extent and what an incredible thrill it is. And when you have to go into that green room, it's not the same.
It's not the same. So let's rate this film. If you're open to doing so, guys. I did not see this film in 99 as we discussed.
Wait, Darren, did you have something else you wanted to say?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off there.
Well, just to bring it home, fascinating to hear you guys actually talk about this as practitioners who've felt the difference between this. Just like for me, like what makes the 13th Warrior interesting watching it now is there is so much about it that to me, as an adult, no longer 14-year-old, feels very artificial. Antonio Banderas' performance, him as a Muslim, some of the dynamics. But then when those scenes just have this incredible tactile feeling to them, you know, when you kind of get the scenes of all the warriors, whose names I never know, but I kind of know some of them. There's the happy guy, there's the tough guy. Like when they're all kind of moving in tandem and just choreographed so well on these kind of built sets, it's weird to feel like, oh, like that really matters to me now. And that almost has gotten better than it would have at the time when I didn't really feel that quite as much. So it's a weird double vision of watching a movie now and almost feeling like, wow, I can see what they do with that today. And I wouldn't like that. And I feel like at least you have that kind of craftsmanship, you know, when they're going down towards the cave and they see that bridge and they built the bridge. Like, I don't know. That's this weird added credibility the movie has that even as so many other facets of it have fallen in my estimation.
Sure.
Somehow that's just risen so much.
Well, it's also just, and forgive me, Kenny, but we talked about, it was Message in a Bottle, where we talked about the boat footage in Message in a Bottle equally terrible to this boat footage. But then a year from now, you'll have A Perfect Storm, and you'll see how Wolfgang Peterson puts the boat in a fucking tank, and he does it properly. And obviously, there's a lot of CG involved in that as well, but we talk about 99 being a fulcrum point for a myriad of things, but one of the biggest ones obviously is special effects, right? And when you look at special effects back then, sometimes they hold up incredibly well, your Matrixes, you know, and whatnot, and then some that don't. You know, I personally think there's a lot of good stuff in Phantom Menace, but there's also a lot of stuff that does not hold up well in that as well. But it's just fascinating to see how in 1 year, they find a way to do something that they fail at pretty miserably in 99, which is putting people on a fucking boat in the water and making it look realistic. I mean, how Castaway is in 2000 as well. Like, it's just, you gotta put the effort in. And admittedly, it's just, you know.
They got real good with boats and waters in the early part of the 2000s. Right? Master and Commander.
Exactly. Yeah,
they did. They had figured it out on a large scale, but
yeah.
I mean, I didn't get to kind of finish my point.
Sorry,
because I lost it. No, it was like an hour ago. But the Viking stuff, there's got to be a fucking. There's no way it's Robert Eggers' version. There's got to be. Not that that's not going to be a great film, but I'm getting at.
I know.
There's got to be the Pirates of the Caribbean for Vikings. There's got to be that big, giant. Epic, because I think what Thor has done, because I remember thinking Thor is the silliest possible superhero and they should pretend he was not in the Avengers and they should never bring him in. And then he's like the third guy in. And it's like, we're going to do this. We're going to we're going to do Norse God superhero.
But they kind of killed it.
Beyond, he's like my favorite character in the MCU. So, like, I think that they could. I think that there is a incredible Viking epic.
I agree.
That I think would be awesome and fun, and I hope it happens. I'm not going to do it.
This is not that movie though. So as I mentioned earlier, never saw this in 99. My knowledge of this film is and Kenny, when Kenny texted me the log line a few days ago, and I was like, that's what this movie's about? Like, all I knew was it was called Eaters of the Dead. It was based on a Crichton thing. I knew the John McTiernan thing. I knew Antonio Banderas. I just assumed it was, I don't know. I really honestly had no idea what it was. So Kenny texted me that. I was like, okay. Sat down to watch this yesterday. I did not hate this movie, but as I mentioned, I had a hard time locking into it. I would, before this podcast, I probably would have given it like a 65, which is, you know, healthy. I feel like that's where it's, I think I'm probably down a little bit after this conversation. I think I'm probably at a 60 now. Like, I don't think this is a bad movie. I think it's pretty well made. It's very well made, in fact, from a technical perspective. I think what's missing for me, and it feels like what's missing for all of us, is, you know, a script that we, you know, characters that we really latched on to. It's not that the script is disposable. It's just I sense that there's swaths of stuff that's been taken out of this, that the ballast of this movie has been kind of taken away in order for just like a rip-roaring ride. And that's
what did Diane Venora think when she saw this movie? Like,
she probably thought, well, The Insider's really good.
Thank God The Insider's coming out. That's the same thing. I know, it's super weird. The Diane Venora stuff is so weird.
Thank goodness. Like, right from, I mean, from famine to feast there with those movies back then.
Yeah, crazy.
Well, you know, I mean, Antonio Banderas also is crazy in Alabama coming out as directorial debut. So he's in great shape.
He's in good shape. A movie I've not seen. I don't even know.
But we will.
We will. We'll cover it.
Okay. So yes, I was prepared to kind of give this movie somewhere in the high 40s, like a 47, 48 before. I gave it a 41 after watching it the first time. And my only comment was, I wish there were real bear men. I am going to go to where I want it, where I was planning. I'm going to go to 47. I think it's almost there. I think it's, I don't think it's a terrible movie. I would not tell someone to watch it. But I'm not upset I did watch it, and I'm kind of happy that it exists. I think it's a plot point that's non-trivial when it comes to the when you track this type of big budget epic, and in that respect, it does have some value. What do you think, Darren?
In 99, what did you give this in 99, Darren?
In 99, this was probably like a 97. This wasn't like a full 100. This was probably I recognize that like there are probably some things in here that are not so hot, but this was a movie that I really walked away enjoying. I think now, just for how much I enjoyed the funny Viking, shout out to Dennis Storhoy, who I've not seen in anything since. This just feels like a movie that, from a really rough beginning, gets better as it goes. And then just by the end, when you have the sort of Beowulf guy just becoming what to me is the ultimate interesting thing with a Viking hero, is they are not afraid of death because they kind of feel like we're all going to die.
Right.
The whole world's going to die. And there's that weird mix of kind of chummy fatalism, laughing at one's fate, with that profound ambition. That's the stuff I lock into.
Their afterlife is like there is an afterlife in Nordic culture that is kind of magical in its own right. I guess my point is leaving this realm isn't necessarily the worst thing in the world.
And it's you know, there's permutations of this, and I'm going to butcher it, but it is the idea of in the afterlife, you know, if you've lived a good life and lived a heroic life, you'll go there and you'll get to kind of keep fighting there, and you'll fight and drink and have fun and fight. And so I think there's all this stuff that's really appealing about them, just in terms of being so different. Mm-hmm. Like, how can they be so boisterous but also just so bleak? So in that sense, it's funny, after watching a lot of the movie and feeling like, this is not a very good film, just right at the end, with the stuff with the Beowulf guy, it kind of hit me a little bit emotionally. So I think this is still a movie that I would say people should watch. This is like a 71, 72 for me. I think.
Okay.
Like,
okay.
This is, and maybe just because, you know, one thing I will say, Gladiator next year, a movie that I think we can all agree is a better movie than 13th Warrior.
I would agree.
The fact that Gladiator starts with this huge, amazing, one of the all-time best battle scenes, and then kind of in some ways towards the back half, for reasons that were kind of beyond its control, dwindles a little bit. Like, that to me feels like a very new millennium movie where there's not the same build. And I do think that, weirdly, not that this movie was composed in an eloquent way whatsoever,
but it does build. Yeah.
There is the sense of a build that I really like. I do feel like, you know, it saves its best stuff for Between the Cave and everything. It saves best stuff for the tail end.
Well, I mean, Gladiator...
that
Yeah, Gladiator definitely suffers from kind of a bit of a lack of momentum to some degree. There's obviously this sort of like this tragedy propulsion going on.
I've never been crazy about Gladiator, but I am kind of crazy about Russell Crowe in that movie. So I think there is that. I think there is that, you know, focusing on the hero thing that kind of puts it above this one. But
I want to stress Russell Crowe in Gladiator is definitely a more entertaining protagonist than Antonio Banderas.
He's not the protagonist. Your big Norse Beowulf is the protagonist in this film.
Yes, that's true. That's true. So Darren, I am.
No, he is the protagonist. Sorry, I don't want people to get me confused.
I'm very curious to hear your thoughts on the movie that we're covering next week.
Okay,
We are covering The Other Sister.
Oh my gosh. This is the Giovanni Ribisi.
Juliette movie? Lewis.
Oh.
I feel like Darren just got punked. Yeah.
It was one of those, I was like, you know what? Listen.
We talked about it for an hour and a half.
Someone's got to get asked the question. And Darren, you're the guy. Do you have thoughts on The Other Sister? Have you seen The Other Sister? Because next week we have LaToya Ferguson on to talk about The Other Sister.
Dying to hear what she has to say. Dying to hear what everyone has to say. I've not seen the movie. I distinctly recall the trailer. And I distinctly recall reading several things about the movie and being, even at the time, feeling a little bit disturbed. Yeah. As if this was something that a lot of people who I trusted seemed very upset about. Uh-huh. But I'm very curious to... Boy, this just kind of goes back to what I was saying earlier about... Yeah. I'm sure you guys have felt this even just over the course of doing this podcast, that like every month we live, 1999 seems to suddenly be like another decade away in terms of what's being made, what kind of stories are being filmed.
What was, quote-unquote, okay to make back then?
What was okay to make. And I'm very curious to... Mm-hmm. Now I almost think I should watch the movie so I can fully engage with the episode.
I think it was definitely one of the films that Kenny and I were concerned about covering, unsure of how it would age. Our concerns were well-founded. I think Kenny and I can both agree that the episode's great. LaToya is an amazing guest,
a brave guest.
We all treaded across a minefield to cover The Other Sister.
It's The Other Sister. It's the irony of The Other Sister, of course, is I think it was pitched as about the most down the middle studio romantic comedy possible. And in 2022, without question, it's the movie that Phil and I dreaded doing the most. You know, whereas a movie like what crazy ass movie, Audition, we were thrilled about doing. We couldn't wait to dive into Audition. So it's Perfect Blue. You know, these crazy ass movies that like would get banned at video stores were like, yes. And everyone in the world is like, these are classics. And this is, you know, worth dissecting. The Other Sister, a fucking Gary Marshall movie, is the most transgressive movie of 1999.
He's also, as we spoke of earlier, had two films that came out in 1999. He had Runaway Bride and The King.
I say transgressive as a joke. Yes. But I do think it does challenge you as an audience member to see what you're capable of sitting through, because it is it is really kind of a truly disturbing, a disturbing slice of where we were at the time. And this whole year, this podcast is about the entire fucking, you know, the entire six foot sub. And this is a little slice only like you only have like the pepper and cheese in there. And you're just like, how did I get a bite with only pepper and cheese and olives?
It's crazy.
It's the story of certainly American culture since 1999. This is why just what you guys do, the archaeology you're doing here is crucial, is almost so many things that were mainstream down the middle then have been so inverted. And in turn, you know, we live in this age when, you know, let's just take, for example, the horror genre of the 80s, stuff that would have at one point seemed fringe or certainly weird. You know, that's kind of the stuff we make our Happy Days nostalgia about now. It's such a bizarre. That's the stuff I show my kids. I'm sure you feel that with that movie in a big way.
Yeah, it was definitely, listen, Kenny and I, when we set out to do all these films, we knew we were going to cover all these films, and we've been excited to do so. And I think that it was truly a fascinating lens with which to look at where we are now. Obviously, I'm glad we covered the episode. It's a great episode. It's a tough movie, and it's always hard to kind of look back and be like, ugh, like it's great that we've learned from it. It's great that this film would never be made today, certainly in the way that it was made back then. But yeah, just a fascinating little artifact of 1999. That's for sure.
Cannot wait. But really, thank you guys.
Oh, thank you for
13-year-old me has been wanting to talk to at least one other person about 13th Warrior for 22
Listen,
years now.
We couldn't have asked for a better guest to talk about 13th Warrior. Seriously. A film that $160 million movie that doesn't exist. It's an amazing thing.
Yeah. Want to see $160 million disappear? Poof, go watch 13th Warrior.
Go watch 13th Warrior. Yeah.
Put it on the poster. Cool cave scene.
Very cool cave scene.
That'll work.
We went to the cave. The cave was there.
Darren, amazing. Do you have a screen draft lined up?
Always doing something there, but nothing that has been officially announced. However, always want to shout out to Screen Drafts. The Patreon's always super active there. They have a lot of cool stuff coming up over there, which I just like. You know, listen, last couple of years, Screen Drafts for me, besides being on that show, has just been a great thing to kind of, great community of people to kind of dig into, of which you guys are an amazing, mayoral candidate part of the small town that is
We're working hard.
Screen Drafts Nation.
We're electioneering over here. A very small part of this podcast has become Screen Drafts fanboying because I listen to every single fucking episode. I really, truly love it. It's just such a joy.
Time. How do you have the time?
In the car, man. In the car. I drive my kids. Their school's 25 minutes away.
Oh, my God. Well,
and I drive them every morning. So yeah.
I was going to say, sorry to jump in. My kids just think everything that produces audio only produces the sound of Clay Keller and Ryan Marker talking about movies. Like car stereo, dad-ass phone.
That's fantastic.
Like, you know, Bluetooth speaker, just perpetually in the background them living their very young lives. It's just people engaged that. in a very, very specific way of ranking movies.
Okay, right.
Thank you so much, Darren, for coming on to talk about this. We hope you'll come back, talk about maybe something from 1989 on our Patreon, perhaps, or something along those lines. But
cannot wait. Thank you guys for having me.
Thank you so much again,
really making young me's dreams come true.
That's what
finally
we do. A podcast
talk about
like
the happy
Viking
guy. One of the best characters of 1999 cinema.
Yeah. Hogarth the Joyous. Much. Darren the Brave.
Bye, guys.
Thanks, guys.
One last thing. Please rate, review, and subscribe. Speaking of subscribing, check out our Patreon on all the best films of 1989. Batman, When Harry Met Sally, Fabulous Baker Boys, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, Ghostbusters 2, Field of Dreams, Major League, and many, many more. We are covering all the best films of 1989 with amazing guests like Joanna Robinson, Liz Hanna, Hunter Covington, Brian Cogman, David Iserson, and many, many more. All your favorite guests from our 1999 podcast are coming on to the 1989 Patreon. You can sign up for it at patreon.com/podcastlikeits1989. For only $5, you get access to all of these awesome episodes. And for a few bucks more, you get video of our 1999 episodes as well. Plus, there are other very cool tiers too, where you can even be a guest on our podcast. Please check out our Reddit as well at reddit.com/podcastlikeits. We're also on Twitter at podcastlikeits1999. We're also on Instagram at podcastlikeits1999. Thank you so much to Ernie and Will for producing our episodes, Sullivan for our social media, Jan Katas for our amazing art and theme songs. And most of all, thank you all for listening.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.